Some of the most important features of any sailing ship are the ropes. Ropes were responsible for everything from holding up a ship's mast to raising, striking, and adjusting the sails. On some ships, there were as many as 36 separate ropes used to guide and support a ship through turbulent waters. That's a lot for a sailor to be responsible for. Some people speculate that it's where the expression "know the ropes" comes from today. In the complex age that we live in, it's just as important that our professionals know the ropes. Can you imagine your surgeon saying, "I made it most of the way through medical school. I think we're going to be okay." What if your lawyer turned to you during the closing arguments of your trial and whispered, "I wish I would have known that that law existed." Not every professional demands the same level of expertise, but there are some areas that we'd be wise not to take chances with. We're not just finding our way through the physical world, we're navigating through a spiritual one as well. The consequences of a misstep in the latter are eternal. Where can we go to find the spiritual wisdom we need to make it through? As we've worked our way through the letter of James, he has pointed his readers and us toward developing a disciplined habit of meditating on Scripture, what he calls looking at the perfect law of freedom. He has invited us to examine ourselves in light of it. But James didn't view transformation as an individual work. Transformation happened in communities of believers that God gifted to support and encourage one another. God gave some people in those communities gifts of teaching. He poured out wisdom to others who prayed diligently for it in faith. Many churches in the 21st century simply hand their visitors a Bible and trust that that's all they need to know the truth and grow in it. But early Christians would have never done that. They would have invited their visitors into the community and helped them to read the Bible in the way that Jesus taught them. They would have coached them and nourished their faith. What would you tell someone today who's looking for a place to gain spiritual wisdom? It sure would be nice if those of us living in the 21st century could just say, "Go to a church, any one of them. You're sure to find everything you'll need there." But so many churches teach such different things on essential spiritual matters that it's impossible to say that all of their spiritual guidance is true. And still others fail to practice what they preach. This is perhaps why trust towards clergy is at an all-time low. What good is advice that costs the advisor too much to follow? It's not easy to point people to trustworthy places to gain spiritual wisdom after all. I think that James felt the same way. Read James chapter 3, verses 13 through 16. Reading between the lines, what kind of challenges do you think James's readers were facing? "Who is wise and understanding among you? Let them show it by their good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. But if you harbor bitter envy and selfish ambition in your hearts, do not boast about it or deny the truth. Such wisdom does not come down from heaven, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder in every evil practice." Who doesn't like to be asked for advice? Who doesn't love to be considered wise? I imagine that James's readers were very proud of their Bible knowledge. Had the description been around back then, they might have even called themselves a Bible church. In verse 13, James invites any one of his readers who considers themselves wise to stand up for a self-examination. Sources of good advice demonstrate that wisdom by good conduct and humility. But James's letter arrived in a place full of envy and selfish ambition. James says, "If these characterize you, don't boast and lie against the truth." Just as people began to raise their hands after listening to James's question, they sheepishly start to pull them down. James's Bible taught that all wisdom belonged to God, and that he was the source of wisdom. That's why James tells his readers who lack wisdom to ask God, who gives generously at the beginning of the letter. James's Bible taught that all wisdom belonged to God and that he was the source of wisdom. That's why James tells his readers who lacked wisdom to ask God, who gives generously at the beginning of the letter. But apparently, some were claiming to have wisdom who really didn't have it at all. Their wisdom did not come from above. Instead, it was earthly as opposed to heavenly, natural as opposed to spiritual, and even demonic as opposed to coming from God. Surely these Christians didn't think they were fraternizing with the devil's servants. James would have been more direct if they did. But something wasn't right about the good wisdom that some were claiming, because real wisdom is inconsistent with envy and selfish ambition in the heart. How did James know that there was envy and selfish ambition in their hearts? Did he know their thoughts? He didn't need to. James says, "For where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice." And those were rampant in these Bible-loving churches. But it's not enough to be familiar with bad advice. If we're going to find sources we can trust, people who really know the ropes, we could use some pointers on how to identify the good kind. James tells his readers what heavenly wisdom looks like. Read James chapter 3, verses 17 through 18. "But the wisdom that comes from heaven is first of all pure, then peace-loving, considerate, submissive, full of mercy and good fruit, impartial and sincere. Peacemakers who sow in peace reap a harvest of righteousness." James's list looks a little unwieldy at first, but with the use of some poetry, he groups the items. The first and foremost characteristic of wisdom is purity. It's the mirror opposite of every evil practice in verse 16. The second set of characteristics are peaceful, yielding, and compliant. James groups these poetically by choosing words that all start with similar sounds in the same Greek letter, epsilon. Together they picture cordial, humble, and peace-loving relationships. The third set of characteristics are tied together by the word full. True wisdom is both full of mercy and good fruit. Good fruit, that is, acts of kindness and generosity, naturally flow out of a heart bubbling up with mercy towards the needy and broken. Finally, James's last two words are connected with the same starting sound as well, a Greek alpha. The first word can be translated impartial or unwavering. But I think the second translation is best, based upon how James uses that root word in other places. An undoubting or unwavering wisdom is also a sincere and genuine wisdom. It's not pretending for the sake of attention. It's grounded and true. The primary tests, then, of heavenly wisdom are purity, peace, good deeds, and sincerity. By sticking close to these, we'll be able to identify good counsel. Let's spend a few moments considering the first two. James says that heavenly wisdom is, first of all, pure. Christian ethical principles have long been fodder for people who choose to live a libertine lifestyle. Christians have been described as prudish, straight-laced, or puritanical in the past. But more often, Christians are now being considered immoral for the wisdom that they hold to. It almost always has to do with sex. This has caused some people to soften the wisdom of God in order to find acceptance in another community. A well-respected preacher was invited to speak at a college campus, and a student journalist asked if she could speak with him afterward. He invited her to walk with him as he made his way to his car. She took the opportunity to confess that she had originally come to listen to his presentation in order to write an opposition piece. She was moved by the presentation and had decided against her previous course. But she was still unsettled about something. She told the preacher, "When I look at Christians like yourself, I respect that you embrace people of different color and you are willing to speak out against racial injustice. Why don't you do the same for LGBT people too?" The preacher paused for a moment to gather the right words. "The reason that we believe that discrimination ethnically is wrong is because the race and ethnicity of a person is sacred. You do not violate a person's ethnicity and race. It's a sacred gift. And the reason we believe in an absoluteness to sexuality is because we believe sexuality is sacred as well. And that's why we make our choice that same way. You will help me if you will tell me why you treat race as sacred and desacralize sexuality." That word pure that James uses to describe heavenly wisdom could also be translated sacred. James reminded his readers earlier in his letter that God is the one who gives every good and perfect gift from above. Sexuality is one of those good and perfect gifts. It is sacred. That means that God has set it apart as something special and life-giving that's to be protected and nourished. If someone takes a fish out of water, it will eventually die. A fish is designed to absorb oxygen dissolved in water, but it cannot take in the oxygen present in our atmosphere. So too, sex is beautifully designed to live and breathe in special circumstances and relationships. When we remove it from those circumstances and relationships, it will die. And when it dies, it no longer becomes the life-giving act that God made it to be. I doubt that James's readers had any trouble with that bit. Perhaps a few of them shook their heads in agreement as they heard James describe heavenly wisdom first and primarily as pure. Maybe they even thought of someone other than themselves who could hear a message like that. But when James continued to describe heavenly wisdom as peaceful, yielding, and compliant, they probably started to shift uncomfortably in their seats. Real wisdom was not just something shown by a person's purity before God. It was demonstrated by their cordiality, humility, and unity among others. But selfish motives and envy were resulting in all sorts of friction among James's readers. James closes this section by saying, "Peacemakers who sow in peace reap a harvest of righteousness." In other words, we should fully expect our methods to coincide with our results. Many Christians feel disenfranchised. It's easy to follow power and make alliances with questionable parties in order to accomplish what we might perceive to be noble goals, but the ends do not justify the means. A wisdom that is unmarked by cordiality, humility, and a love for peace will not produce true peace in the end. A Christian professor recently shared with me an encounter she had with one of her students. "You're a Christian? Isn't that a violent religion?" she asked, citing a hate group that claimed to be Christian. The teacher graciously explained that no, Christians were not like that, and used the opportunity to tell her that God is a God of love instead. But not everyone gets an opportunity to clarify. Our methods matter, and they impact our message. Where can we find the spiritual wisdom we need to make it through? True wisdom is characterized by purity, peace, good deeds, and sincerity. Make sure your counselors are too. Read James chapter 3, verses 13 through 18 again, and answer the following questions. Why do you think James describes wisdom as pure, first of all? Why do you think unwavering, other translations say impartial, and sincere are used to complete the characteristics of true wisdom? Explain.